What was that about? Amber asked.
That dude was losing hard. I wanted to help.
Daniel had looked for the guy after class, but lost him in the shuffle to leave Peterson Hall.
A bunch of us are getting drinks on Saturday at the Black Cat, Amber said, in her shaggy but upbeat voice.
She still lived at home, still hung out with the same friend she'd had in high school, and was taking summer classes so she could finish college in 3 years.
That sounds fun.
On Saturdays, Daniel would join Amber, Kelsey Ortman, and their other friends for beers at one of the two animal-named bars on Main Street in Littletown, down the hill from the Carlo campus. The Black Cat and the Spotted Cow. 1 week, there'd been an off-campus party, a near duplicate of the parties he had gone to at Potsdam. White people dancing badly to corny hip-hop in a ramshackle house. Beer bongs and screaming guys in baseball caps. Someone barfing on the front lawn.
They have an open mic there on Thursdays. Didn't she used to be into music in high school? With Roland Fentes?
Amber pronounced it Fentes.
Wasn't he, like, a little off in high school? With the green hair? He wore eyeliner.
I used to play guitar. We had a few bands back then.
Amber's white blonde hair was almost transparent in the sun.
A bunch of us should check out the open mic one night.
Sure, that sounds good,
Daniel said, though he couldn't think of anything he wanted to do less.
Harry's class will be a good entree for you into the world of economics,
Peter said at dinner.
A solid foundation for your future. There are so many ways that knowing economic theory can help enrich your life, from tracking your budget to knowing how to manage your stock portfolio.
If only they made it a required class for all undergraduates.
Kay asked him how Melissa's class was today. Melissa was Professor Schenkman, a heavyset woman who wore long dresses and 80s prints, geometric overlapping shapes in hot pinks and lavenders. Daniel remembered going to her house as a kid. Summer barbecues with other faculty families.
Good,
Daniel said. Professor Schenkman always made it a point to call on him, as if she was doing a favor to Kay, ensuring he got his tuition's worth. They were having broccoli and chicken parmesan. At least Kay had ceased her efforts to cook Chinese food.
These efforts flared up periodically. Once after they'd visited the Hennings and Elaine had given her a cookbook, and another time after he'd gone to a week-long camp for Chinese adoptees, where the college-aged counselors, also adoptees, talked with such bare emotion that he felt embarrassed for them. Angel had learned how to make oddly sweet wontons that summer, but he was the only kid there who had been adopted past the age of infancy, who remembered anything about his birth mother.
Kay had become careful around him, overly solicitous. He knew she worried when he went out for drinks, so he made sure to be home by midnight, which wasn't hard. There was only so much time he could stand being around Amber and her friends. He could see how it reassured her. All it took to make her and Peter happy was to come home and go to Carlo. Say he was going to GA meetings. After dinner, Peter called Daniel upstairs to the study, where he was kneeling on the carpet with a mess of computer cables, whistling softly.
Where does this go?
Peter peered over his reading glasses.
Here, let me.
Daniel took the cord and tried several slots before a green light flashed on the speakers.
Aha! Take a seat.
Peter cleared some old bills from a folding chair, typed in a website address and pulled up a YouTube screen.
Look at that. You can get all kinds of music for free online. The other day, I watched footage from a concert I attended in 1978. Aerosmith at the War Memorial Arena in Syracuse. I was 21. Your age. Can you imagine? A concert you go to today. Seeing it online in 40 years?
This was the most Peter had said to him in months that wasn't lecture-based.
Is that what we're going to watch now? Did you see yourself in the audience? No, you can only see the stage. And barely even that. Video technology was primitive back then.
Peter pressed play.
But here, listen to that.
It was video footage of an actual record spinning as it played Jimi Hendrix's 1983, A Merman I Should Turn to Be. Daniel and Peter sat in their chairs and listened as the track slowed to a break and picked up again. Creeping. Plodding.
That backwards tape. It's a slow burn, Peter said. They didn't need computers to make good music in those days. It's a good track, Dad. One of his best.
I used to listen to this song when I was a kid.
The age you were when you came to live with us in Ridgeboro. I had a few of my older brother's records that he left behind when he took off for college. We used to share a room. And after he left, I'd sit on his bed and listen to his records. That's where I got my music taste from. Your Uncle Phil. They say you always maintain a fondness for the first records you listened to. Like you and Hendrix. I listened to music before Hendrix.
There'd been music in the city. Plenty of it. And even Hendrix seemed kind of childish to him now. The song transitioned into red-tipped sparkles, feedback and clanging bells. A shift in keys felt like the sun peeking through the clouds.
I'm working on some new music,
Daniel said.
Trying to, at least. You'd like it. It's just vocals and guitar. No computers. It's really different from what Roland and I were doing.
Peter delivered a few soft slaps to the back of Daniel's shoulder.
I'm glad you're back in school. Glad you're back at home.
How easy it was to make Peter proud. How hungry he was for Peter's approval.
I know.
At the Food Lion, picking up groceries for Kay, he heard a voice go,
"Hey! Wilkinson!"
and saw Cody Campbell in a cashier's uniform, waving to him from one of the registers. Cody looked mushier than he'd been in high school, where he had played football. He was still bulky, but his muscle had converted to fat. Daniel got into Cody's checkout line.
"Hey, Cody. I heard from Amber and Kelsey that you're back in town. Thought I'd see you around." "What have you been up to?"
"Same old, same old."
Cody scanned a package of frozen peas.
"Hoping to get out to Colorado soon. Couple buddies of mine are there. Brian Mitchell and Mike Evans? They're going too. Mike's brother lives out there. Says they legalized weed. You can walk into his store and pick up edibles there, like you're going to the grocery store. You can buy it with your credit card. Get stoned, like, right there."
"Wow. Colorado, huh?"
"Yeah. You coming out to the Black Cat tomorrow?"
"I think I'm busy," Daniel said.
The next night, the phone rang on the landline and Kay called up the stairs.
"It's for you, Daniel."
He was staring at his notes for Professor Schenkman's class. Their final assignment, 3 short essays, were due tomorrow, and he hadn't begun. When he tried to work on them, he would end up Googling psychic hearts, which was how he found out they were playing Jupiter at the end of August. He picked up the extension in the study.
"Hey, it's Cody. You want to grab a beer?"
"I would, but another night."
Daniel was about to hang up when Cody said,
"Hey, you still smoke?"
They drove out to the pond at the bottom of Cedar Street, where they had hung out on summer nights in high school. Cody pulled his Jeep into a clearing at the edge of the woods and parked.
"You still live with your folks?"
Daniel asked, as they passed a bowl back and forth. He couldn't see anything outside. The darkness vast. The silence eerie. He switched on the radio, which was tuned to a classic rock station. Pearl Jam flew out.
Yeah, but...
Cody flicked the lighter.
I'm getting out soon. Got to save up.
Daniel took another hit. Several moments passed, and the familiar, grateful fuzziness arrived. He leaned back in the passenger seat, thinking he should buy weed off Cody and go to class high.
For Colorado.
Right. I have to get my cash money in order, you know? I have some debt I have to pay off, but I'm working on it.
I have some of that, too. Debt.
Sucks, man. Fuck a debt.
Cody packed another bowl. The car was choked with smoke.
Hot boxing in the front of my Jeep.
He sang to the tune of Party in the USA. His voice wasn't half bad.
Nice. You should record an album. Roland and I recorded one a few weeks ago. With this record collective in the city. Melancholia? You know it? The band, Psychic Hearts. We're playing a show on August 18 at Jupiter. This club down in the city.
In Colorado, Cody was saying, there's mountains everywhere. You can live on a mountain and ski to work. That's what I'm going to do.
I don't know how you could live in New York City. It's fun to party in, but it smells like a bag of assholes. Anyway, I couldn't live in one of those little apartments that cost $9,000 a month. I want a house in a mountain. A whole house in a whole motherfucking mountain.
It doesn't cost $9,000. That's only for celebrities. So where are you going to live?
What? I said, Colorado.
I mean in Colorado. Where are you going to live in Colorado?
In a mountain! I said that!
You're not listening.
Where Mike's brother lives.
I forget the name of the town. His name's Chris. When did you visit him?
This was ridiculous. Daniel wanted to tell Roland about getting faded with Cody Campbell at the pond at the bottom of Cedar. About going to Econ every morning with Amber Bitburger. But he hadn't spoken to Roland since getting kicked out of the rehearsal space.
It wasn't like Roland had contacted him, either.
But he missed Roland, damn it. Missed him like subways and rooftops and singing. Even if being back in Ridgeboro was an unanticipated reprieve. He had eliminated the possibility of feeling out of place by banishing himself to no place. Stoic nights alone in his bedroom or flipping through news magazines with Peter and Kay.
I haven't gone there yet, Wilkinson. I saw pictures. I told you, I've got to get my money in order, pay off that debt. But I'm working on it. I'm figuring it out. Like you. Gonna make our dreams happen, right?
Cody held out the pipe.
More?
Yes, please.
Cody's phone chirped, signaling a new text.
It's Amber. She wants to know if we can go to the stupid open mic at the stupid Black Cat.
Let's go.
Daniel wanted to be around other people.
Even if they were Amber and Kelsey.
He rolled down the window and heard crickets and frogs over the radio. But the woods seemed sinister. Foreboding. One time in high school, Mike Evans had driven his brother's moped into the pond.
You serious?
Come on. You can grab a beer. Chill.
Cody considered this.
I am kind of parched.
In the back room of the Black Cat, the only business open on a block of boarded-up storefronts, four middle-aged men were playing a cover of Guns N' Roses' Paradise City. Amber and Kelsey waved Daniel and Cody over from a table near the stage.
You guys found each other, Amber said. You smell like a bong.
Like Colorado,
Daniel said.
How's all that studying going for your test tomorrow, Wilkinson?
What test?
Daniel poured himself a glass of beer from the pitcher on the table. The band broke into a guitar solo, and the lead singer, bald and stocky,
started headbanging. Daniel laughed.
These guys suck.
They're not that bad, Kelsey said.
They'd last half a song in the city until they got booed off stage.
Guns N' Roses is all right.
Cody screwed up his face and played air guitar. His fingers weren't even in the right places for the imaginary frets and strings.
You're in the jungle now!
I don't care if they suck. I don't care.
Kelsey shrieked.
Oh my God, you guys are twins!
Daniel looked down. He was wearing his hiking boots, even in the middle of the summer, because he didn't have any other shoes. Cody was wearing a pair, too. Both of them wore blue jeans and black t-shirts.
You're like the Asian version of Cody, Amber said.
And everyone laughed. Kelsey took a picture with her phone. Cody said, with a fake lisp,
We planned our outfits together.
The singer screeched. The band, at least, looked like they were having fun. He came home at midnight, his buzz long gone, and lay on top of the same quilt that had been there when he'd first become Daniel. Those early months in Ridgeboro had been suspicious, begrudging. But at some point it had become easier to play along. It had become second nature. The doubts had burrowed deeper until he barely felt them at all. By his last year in high school, thinking of Deming or Mama was like remembering a terrible band he had once loved but now filled him with mortification. Only once, in high school, after he saw the Chinese woman in the mall, had he let things slip. When Kay and Peter had told him that he had to stay home and study for the SATs instead of going to see a band with Roland, Deming had said his real mother would have let him go. It had popped out, unbidden. Real mother, an abstraction. Mama would probably have made him stay home. He hadn't meant to hurt Kay and Peter that much, but he was angry at the injustice. If he missed this show, he might never see this band again. And Kay had winced and told him it wasn't the end of the world.
We are your real family,
Peter had said. Back then, the mystery of what happened to his real family had been too enormous to solve. But now he had found them, and nothing had changed. He'd have to pull an all-nighter to finish the essays. Shankman had returned his last paper marked up in red pen. He typed his name out on a blank Word document, followed by the date. The cursor blinked back at him as he read the first question again. Discuss two major theories that characterize the role played by interest groups in U.S. politics. Describe the insights these theories can offer regarding the operations of the legislative process. He sighed. He had never seen the guy who was playing poker in econ class again. Amber said he might have dropped out. Daniel closed his laptop and decided to take his guitar out instead. A new thing was forming. Not the essay he was supposed to write, but the song he'd been working on before he left the city. 2 hours later, when he returned to the essay, he saw an email from Angel. He'd been sending her the occasional message, but this was the first time she had responded. Daniel, please don't text me anymore. I wish you the best. A. He read it again. She had wished him the best. It was proof she still cared for him. Otherwise she wouldn't have bothered to write at all. He recalled her clear, low voice, devoid of shrillness or forced emotion, and craved her decisiveness, her competence. He would keep writing her until she understood. Because here was a way he had changed. He'd lost his mother and Roland, things that should have made him feel worthless and rejected. Yet it hadn't destroyed him. He'd do it for Angel then. School, grades, career. Show her he could get it together. She would have to forgive him. He hit reply. A streak of hope. I'm going to do better for you.
14. The front of the card was pastel blue plaid.
Dear Dad, he wrote. Happy Father's Day. Love, Daniel.
I was thinking, Kay said, sitting next to Daniel at the kitchen table. Since it's Father's Day and all.
He folded the card into the envelope, licked and sealed it, wrote, Dad, on the front.
About how Mother's Day has always been a little uncomfortable for me. I appreciate how you always give us cards. But I can guess that maybe these aren't the most comfortable holidays for you, either.
I don't mind.
I mean, when you were younger, I thought I didn't deserve to celebrate the holiday. That it was, I don't know, inauthentic for me to do so as an adoptive mother. Elaine was the one who told me, just embrace it. It didn't do you any good to have a parent doubting her ability. You needed a mother. And if I wasn't a mother, then who was?
Kay ran her fingers along the edge of the table.
I had those doubts a lot when you first came to live with us.
Daniel pushed his empty sandwich plate around in a semicircle. Peter was upstairs in the study. He should go spend more time with Peter.
It was Father's Day.
Kay's eyes flipped from Daniel's face to the wall to the kitchen window.
We were so afraid of doing something wrong. We thought it would be better if you changed your name so you would feel like you belonged with us. With our family. That you had a family.
Daniel never knew if Kay wanted him to apologize or reassure her.
Either way, he always felt implicated. Like there was some expectation he wasn't meeting.
Mom. He didn't want to see her cry, especially if it was on his behalf. It's okay.
Kay got up, and he heard her opening the drawer of the dining room cabinet. She returned, placing a fat manila envelope on the table.
What's this?
It's all the records we have concerning your adoption. The correspondence with the foster care agency. The forms we filled out. I've been meaning for you to have them.
Daniel opened the envelope and flipped through the stack of paper. Saw the forms and emails he'd read that afternoon 10 years ago.
Thanks.
There would be nothing in here he hadn't seen before.
Your father didn't agree with me about doing this. He said it would only stir up bad memories. But I insisted.
Daniel bent the envelope's metal clasp back and forth.
I do know some things, actually. I should tell you. I found my mother recently. I mean, my birth mother. She's in China.
He told Kay about how his mother had gone to work and never came home. How Leon had left for China 6 months later. How Vivian had gotten him fostered. That his mother might have been deported. Kay looked like she'd been punched.
I spoke to her.
He finally said.
Twice.
What did she say? What was it like?
Kay's smile was trembling at the sides. So strained it looked like it hurt.
It was good, though a little weird. And my Chinese is rusty, but we managed to understand each other. She lives in Fuzhou. And she's married and working as an English teacher.
Are you going to talk to her again?
Maybe.
Kay picked up the envelope and tapped the bottom of it against the table, straightening out the papers inside.
By the way, she said, I received a curious phone call the other day. From Charles, Angel's boyfriend.
Oh?
He said you borrowed money from Angel and haven't paid her back. I asked him why he was calling me about, and he said I should ask you. So, I'm asking. Daniel tried to detect whether he heard an accusation in Kay's statement, whether she was still assuming the worst from him. If he was the Daniel that fucked up or the Daniel who needed to be cared for.
She must have been talking about this one time we met up in the city. I didn't have any cash on me and I had to borrow some to pay for dinner.
It sounded like more than that. What Charles said, it sounded serious. And wasn't she talking at Jim's birthday party about a thief?
It's not serious. He's making it up.
But why would her boyfriend call me and make something like that up? Please, explain.
There's nothing to explain. For all I know, he might be jealous of me and Angel being such good friends. Some guys get like that.
Daniel saw, in Kay's expression, the same mix of hurt and suspicion as when she learned about his expulsion from Potsdam. He got up, taking the envelope.
But you reminded me that I forgot to pay Angel back. I'm going to go do that now. On my computer.
He passed both his classes for the first part of the summer term. A C+ in comparative politics and a B in microeconomics. The second part proceeded in the same joyless vein. Macroeconomics in the mornings, an American history course in the afternoons.
In late July, a lone text message appeared from Roland, asking Daniel how he was doing. Daniel wrote back, congratulating Roland on the Jupiter gig and wishing him the best, echoing Angel's wish to him in her email, which had been insincere, as she'd sicked Charles on him. That night, he borrowed Peter's Volvo and drove around by himself. He had missed driving while in the city, the steering wheel hard beneath his palm, free hand floating out the open window with air thick between his fingers, the easy slide down the curving two-lane roads. He remembered driving through the night with Roland their senior year, all the way to Boston, drinking gas station coffee and singing along to mixed CDs. They'd been driving to a friend's house when they decided to get on the highway and keep going east. Couldn't bear another Saturday night in Ridgeboro. And when they got to Boston, they had breakfast at a diner. Waffles and pancakes and Western omelets. A bright winter morning with flurries of snow. Daniel had watched the joggers in their thermal outfits crossing the bridge over the Charles River. College students in sweaters and scarves toting large cups of coffee. He had dreamt about leaving home and being on his own. About the life that awaited him once he left Ridgeboro. When he could be free, in the way Michael thought he already was. Now, looping around town with no destination, his phone plugged into the car's speakers, skipping from song to song and album to album and growing bored with each track after a few seconds, he was sick of all his music. 5,000 songs and not a damn thing to listen to. The music went silent. He pulled over to the shoulder. Either his phone's battery had died, or the cable needed to be replugged. He rolled down the windows and heard layers of chirping crickets, opened the door and walked out to the street. There were houses in the distance, the occasional light, and a swath of tall grass on the corner he pushed around with his feet. He and Roland used to practice wheelies on their dirt bikes near here. He stood still, absorbing the night. For so long, he had thought that music was the one thing he could believe in. Harmony and angular submelody and rolling drums. A world neither present nor past. A space inhabited by the length of a song. For a song had a heart of its own. A song could jumpstart or provide solace. Only music could numb him more thoroughly than weed or alcohol. With Roland, he had wanted to fill other people's silences, drown out their thoughts and replace them with sound. It was less about communication, more about assault and plunder. That was how he'd preferred it. But standing on the dark street, a pressure released inside him. The crickets a consolation for his remorse over leaving the city. That he had pushed his mother away before she could tell him the truth. Most nights Daniel began to stay in. He did homework, wrote music, used an old condenser mic to record several tracks onto Peter's computer, which ran a pirated version of Pro Tools faster than his laptop. The songs he was writing weren't anything like the ones he and Roland played. They lacked structure, didn't cohere in a predictable way. They were too bare, too vulnerable. They cared too much to be cool. He no longer wanted to make music that forced itself on you, or trying to be something it wasn't. The challenge was not to overstate, but to be honest, unguarded. In class, he worked on lyrics as Professor Nichols droned on about X and Y variables. It felt like he was defrosting a windshield, that the fog would eventually reveal clear glass. In the back of his closet, he found a stack of cassettes. One of them had a label drawn in marker. Necromania! Brains on a spike! He remembered recording it on Roland's mom's old tape player one afternoon. His first year in Ridgeboro. The two of them wailing along to a three-chord backing track they had downloaded online. He put the tape in a padded envelope along with a note that said, "Remember when we used to jam?" and mailed it to Roland's apartment. He was at Cody's on a Friday night in August, in the Campbells' basement, watching an MMA fight. Cody was the only person he talked to these days, besides Peter and Kay. Amber wasn't taking classes for the rest of the summer and had gone to visit family in Connecticut. The match ended. The guy in the red shorts standing over the prone body of the guy in the black shorts. Blood ran down both their faces. Daniel had transferred the tracks he'd mastered from Peter's computer to his phone. "You want to hear something I'm working on?" Cody looked over. "Will you turn the volume down for a second?" "Hold on." Cody waited to see if the announcer was saying anything important. When the match switched to a commercial, he hit mute. Daniel took out his phone. He heard the familiar first notes, the guitar, his own voice, tinny and monotone on the microspeaker. The sound was too poor to make out most of the words.
"That you?"
Cody said.
"Yep."
The song didn't need any more changes or rewrites. It didn't matter if he'd ever perform. It was exactly what he wanted it to be.
"You've changed, Wilkinson,"
Cody said, after the song ended.
"How so?" "In high school, you were all like..."
Cody hunched over, curling his shoulders in and looking down at the carpet.
"Leave me alone," he said. "You barely spoke English. Now you're all American." "What the hell are you talking about? I spoke English." "You called that English?" "Fuck off, Cody. Fuck you." "You need a drummer," Cody said, as Daniel headed toward the door. "Like those guys at the Black Cat open mic. They rocked."
He couldn't sleep. He decided to sit on the porch. Looking for his phone, he spotted the manila envelope from Kay, grabbed it, and then went outside. Beneath the porch light, he examined the printout of the permanency hearing report. Foster parents planned to petition for a termination of mother's parental rights on grounds of abandonment. He held the envelope upside down and shook it hard.
until the rest of the contents fell into his lap. There was the surrender form, with Vivian's signature. Placement indefinite. Another form she signed, authorizing his foster placement. There was a smaller envelope, too, tucked into the papers, which contained a transcript of his grades from PS33. He'd gotten straight C's and D's in fifth grade. A note from his teacher, a Ms. Torelli, that said he should take remedial classes. Another note that said he had been in detention on February 15. He had forged his mother's signature on the required line, and must have neglected to return it to school after she disappeared. There was a black-and-white photograph of him and his mother paper-clipped to one of the forms. The bottom half of the picture a printed illustration of the Empire State Building, the Statue of Liberty, and a yellow cab driven by a googly-eyed giraffe, along with a caption for the South Street Seaport. He was a baby, fat cheeks in a swirl of dark hair, and his mother looked like a child herself, younger than he remembered her. It was the only baby picture of himself he had ever seen. The only picture of her he had. Why hadn't Peter and Kay given it to him before? He pulled it closer to his face, pictured Vivian packing his clothes for him, finding the detention form, calling the school for his transcripts, going through his mother's things and digging up the photograph. She had put it in the pile for him to have. A single memento of his mother. Dumped it all in an envelope and handed it over to social services. But had Vivian done these things? Or had Leon? Or was it his mother? Had she had a hand in it? He examined the possibilities. His mother had been in jail. She'd been deported. She loved him. She didn't care. You could play it one way and play it another, the same note sounding different depending on how you decided to hear it. You could try to do all the right things and still feel wrong inside. He found her number, still in his phone, and called one last time. She didn't answer. The next day, he registered for the fall classes Peter and Kay suggested. And when Kay said, "You paid Angel back, right?" he said he had. To celebrate Daniel finishing the summer with passing grades, Peter and Kay took him out to dinner at the Ridgeboro Inn, where they had gone for his high school graduation, the publication of Kay's book, and Peter's promotion to department chair after Valerie McClellan had retired. The inn was a dimly lit cave with wooden beams and obsequious elderly waiters in heavy maroon and gold uniforms, a matching menu listing steaks and chops and French onion soup in ornate cursive font. It was the only restaurant near Ridgeboro where you didn't look out of place in a jacket and tie. Peter ordered a bottle of Malbec. The waiter filled their glasses, and Peter raised his.
"To Daniel. For being back on the right path. To the beginning of the rest of your life."
Daniel had borrowed a tie of Peter's and wore the one suit jacket he had, the sleeves now short on him, but the shoulders loose. He kept adjusting the tie, pulling down on the cuffs. Even his pants were tighter than they had been a few months ago, now that he drove instead of walking. The right path was veering off the side of a cliff. Peter and Kay were beaming.
"We're proud of you," Kay said.
He blew on his soup to cool it, used his spoon to break up the bread on top. A tendril of steam escaped, still too hot to eat. He placed his spoon on the table, its round face shining up at him like a query. The waiter hovered over them, offering pepper for their salads. Small candles twinkled on the tables, but the maroon wallpaper and thick curtains made the room cold and dark. Paintings with Baroque brass frames hung from the walls. Portraits of men in military uniforms, women in long dresses, their expressions pinched and severe. Landscapes of rolling hills and weeping willows. White farmhouses in the distance.
That's the famous Ridgeboro Oxbow.
Peter squinted at a painting of a meadow with a river on one side.
I don't see any oxen,
Daniel said.
Oxbow. The river is making an oxbow there. See, it bends this way and that. This must be former Wilkinson land. Here in the painting. My grandfather mentioned it in the family history he wrote before he passed.
Peter's voice rose.
Your great-great-grandfather owned that land once. He grew vegetables. He had horses. He was an enterprising man. Jacob Wilkinson.
Daniel pressed his spoon into his soup again. There was a quiet sorrow about the weighted silver cutlery, the paintings of bygone people and places. He was the last of the Wilkinsons, the only grandchild. His only cousins were on Kay's side of the family, and they had his Uncle Gary's last name. The way Peter spoke about it, being the last of the line was a great responsibility. He had to do something special to live up to Jacob Wilkinson's legacy. This man he looked nothing like, whom, if he had been alive, would probably never accept Daniel as a true Wilkinson. The spoon peered up at him, and he looked down at the metal, hoping to see his reflection. But it was too dark to see anything but drops of soup. The night before the first day of fall semester, Daniel edited a track on Peter's computer. His voice sounded strange, pitching sharp, too forceful for the melody. The shelves in the study housed an overflow of books, with somber covers and lengthy titles about democracy and open markets. Copies of Peter and Kay's own books filled half a shelf. He'd looked at them before. Had seen the author biographies and photographs. Peter's book was dedicated to Daniel and Kay. Kay's to Daniel and Peter. The wall above the computer showcased their diplomas. Bachelor's, master's, and doctoral degrees for both of them. Framed proof of their other accomplishments. Awards, articles, book reviews, and academic journals. Surrounded him. He took his headphones off. The song wasn't working. He walked past Peter and Kay's room to make sure they were still asleep, then came back to the study and shut the door, telling himself it wouldn't work, that he was only trying because he wanted to make sure it wouldn't work. He typed "Big Poker" into the browser. Breath quickening, he typed .com. And hit return. He remembered an old account, one he'd barely used and hadn't told Peter and Kay about. The homepage loaded, and seeing the green background and digital cards felt like running into an old girlfriend. There was $50 in this forgotten account. He would play just one game and log out, then cancel everything. He started on a table of chumps. Like that guy in his econ class. And someone named Aardvark Texas went all in with a pair of queens. Daniel called, holding pocket aces. But then he couldn't quit while ahead. One game turned into two, which turned into a sit-and-go. And another. And his account was up to $100. Then $300. Then $5. He danced in the chair. Listening to the clinks and chimes of chips and cards, woozy from the rush, until he felt a hand on his shoulder.
I knocked,
Peter said.
Dad?
His heart pounded. He couldn't help it.
He turned to the screen to confirm his winning hand. His account ticked up. As Peter watched, Daniel pumped his fist in the air. This time, Peter was calm, like he'd been expecting this.
All right. That's enough now.
It was 7 in the morning. Daniel packed his backpack, the same one he had brought with him to the city, but left his guitar in his room. He'd have them send it to him later, wherever he was going. Kay sat at the kitchen table, drinking a cup of tea. There were half-moon shadows under her eyes, which were puffy from crying.
You're not going to ask me to stay?
She shook her head. I got an email from Elaine. He pulled his bag onto his shoulder.
I'll let myself out.
15. He remembered nothing about the flight. Only darkness, rocking. Then waking 19 hours later to sunlight slamming through the window, walking off the plane and into a humid afternoon. One full day disappeared. The lone runway was surrounded by potholed streets, a long line of dirt and rocks, like the airport had been dropped into a sandbox. Language flew around him at warp speed, harsher and throatier than the same dialects he'd heard in New York. Motorcyclists circled like vultures.
Fuzhou!
They barked.
Fuzhou!
He took a step forward, and 3 motorcyclists braked and shouted,
Get on, quick!
The first man said, and Daniel balanced himself on the seat and was fixing the straps of his backpack when the driver accelerated and he flew forward.
Grab on!
The guy said. He wrapped his arms around the man's waist, coughing back exhaust as they shot through the streets. He saw other motorcyclists and passengers wearing smog masks.
Where you going?
The driver asked.
Fuzhou!
Daniel yelled.
Where in Fuzhou?
Downtown?
Wuyi Square!
Yeah,
Daniel said. They careened down a long road, empty except for the occasional passing truck. Daniel spat out gravel and dust, and the wind blew a glob of saliva back onto his jeans. He couldn't let go of the driver's waist, so the spit sat on his thigh, taunting him, spreading into the fabric. Green fields and hills were punctuated by clusters of buildings. With their knobby trunks and feathery leaves, the trees seemed older, friendlier, than the pines and oaks of upstate New York.
Where you from?
The driver asked, as the fields gave way to taller buildings.
America.
Ha!
New York.
Chinese?
The driver asked.
Yes.
Cantonese?
Fujianese.
The driver made a sound like pshaw.
No.
Yes, my mother is from Minjiang.
The 4-lane road was clogged with cars and buses. The driver slowed to a standstill, surrounded by a solid mass of traffic, all of it honking in unison. Then lit a cigarette, the smoke drifting directly into Daniel's face. The light changed to green, and the driver threw the cigarette onto the ground and accelerated, Daniel bouncing hard against his back. He was dropped off on a busy street near a Pizza Hut and a shopping mall.
You know a hotel around here?
Over there,
the driver said, gesturing to the other side of an overpass in a traffic circle. He had a small, pimpled baby face, and Daniel saw that they were around the same age.
How much for the ride?
150 yen.
Daniel took out 200 yen bills from the money he'd gotten at the airport currency exchange.
You speak funny.
The driver handed Daniel his change.
You've got a Cantonese accent.
It wasn't until Daniel was paying for a room at the Min Hotel, a 6-story building with wall-to-wall orange carpet, that he realized the driver had given him only 10 yuan in change. His room was on the 3rd floor at the end of a long hallway, a double room with 2 queen-sized beds, more expensive than the singles. It was the only room they had available, the clerk said, and Daniel had been too tired, too humiliated by his accent, to argue. He crawled into the bed closest to the window, the sheets and pillows smelling like cigarette smoke, though he'd requested a non-smoking room. He would call her when he was more coherent. Maybe then he would sound less Cantonese. He woke up 3 hours later, head aching, the room dark. According to the clock, it was early evening, and when he opened the curtains, it was still light out. A line of buses idled in traffic below. A crowd of people were standing outside the Pizza Hut. Overwhelmed, he sat down on the bed. He calculated what time it was in New York, how long it had been since he'd eaten. He turned on his phone and dialed his mother's number. But it wouldn't go through. He tried again and got the same result. There was no wireless internet in the hotel, so he couldn't get online to see if he had to dial a special code. He tried again using the phone by the bed, but it only produced an automated recording that said he was unable to make this phone call. It was Planet Ridgeboro all over again.
"You'll have to dial this code," the clerk said, when he went down to the front desk.
"Even for a nearby call?"
The clerk's eyebrows resembled subtraction signs.
"Your cell won't work here," she said. "If you use the phone in your room and punch in this code, you should be able to complete the call. We can charge any phone calls to your account if you give us a credit card."
Daniel tried to decipher the clerk's rapid words as he grasped for a response. He took out his credit card. He'd already charged the flight. A couple phone calls wouldn't make a difference. He returned to the room and called his mother's number again, using the phone by the bed. This time, he got her voicemail.
"Mama, it's Deming. I'm in Fuzhou and I want to see you. I'm staying at the Min Hotel in Wuyi Square, room 323. Please call me."
He left the phone number for his room and went out in search of dinner. Fuzhou smelled like a barbecue in autumn. The buildings had windows that reminded him of eyes, tracking his winding journey. Some buildings were wide and curved, with long strips of windows like slices of gray masking tape. Others tall and skinny, with sharp or circular rooftops. Some buildings looked like an open greeting card, set on a table with arms flung out to embrace him. Others were only partially constructed, their tops a skeletal cage of scaffolding, and from a distance they resembled a band of mismatched toys. There was an architectural incongruence, but it made sense. Daniel preferred disorder to order, liked the trees in the spaces between buildings, leaves touching the low roofs of older homes. The city looked like it was trying to build itself up but would never fully succeed. This was an underdog city, ambitious and messily hungry, so haphazard it could collapse one night and be reassembled by the following morning. The sounds of Fuzhou were deep yellows, blues, and oranges. Fuzhouese and Mandarin banged out around him, the playlist of his unconscious. And even the words and phrases he didn't recognize were like falling into a warm bath. There was not one scrap of English. Not anywhere. Not in the street signs and bus stops and billboards. Not in the voices he overheard. Nor in the music sliding out of taxis. It was trippy. surreal. The swirl of familiar sounds on such unfamiliar streets. He'd never been to Fuzhou before, but it was a place he already knew. His brain struggling to stay alert, he repeated to himself in English, "I'm in China. I'm in China." He turned to avoid a moped careening down the sidewalk, and a bicyclist nearly swerved into him. When he stopped, the woman behind him yelled, "Move it!" He ducked into the nearest store to get his bearings. After a little effort, he recalled the word for map and bought one of the city. But when he unfolded it, the street names were in Chinese characters and he couldn't read a thing. He saw a family heading onto a crooked side street, nearly hidden in the high-rises, and followed them along a stone wall plastered with signs exhorting the importance of washing your hands after you sneeze. Stepping over puddles with an oily sheen in the center, he walked into a courtyard. The noise from Wuyi Square had disappeared, and the buildings reminded him of the houses on Three Alley, two-story homes with brick walls and hanging laundry. Children played as old women sat on plastic stools and fanned themselves with newspapers, talking about how so-and-so's daughter was marrying so-and-so's son. Inside the houses, he saw families cooking and eating dinner. A lump formed in his throat. He found a noodle stall tucked between two of the houses and ordered a bowl of vermicelli noodles and pork broth with vegetables. Glad nobody commented on his Fujianese. The food appeared and he scarfed it down, drank cups of watery tea until his headache subsided. On his way back to the hotel, he got lost, went the long way around a construction site of eerie half-demolished structures, and by the time he found Wuyi Square, it was dark. No new messages for him in the hotel room. Daniel took a long shower, filling the bathroom with steam clouds. He called his mother again, left her another message, then lay down. He woke at 7 in the morning with the light streaming through the open curtains. She still hadn't called him. A heavy stinging grew behind his eyes. He had made it here. But she didn't want to see him. And he had no one to go home to. 2 mornings ago, he had left Ridgeboro with $960 in his bank account. During a lull in the middle of the night drama with Kay and Peter, he quietly cashed out of the game, charged a ticket to Fuzhou leaving from the Syracuse airport the following afternoon, and deleted the poker account. On the corner of Oak Street at 7 in the morning, he called Cody. "Can you do me a huge favor?" he'd said. "I need a ride to the airport." Cody arrived in his Jeep with a goodbye present, a baggie of Vicodin from his recent wisdom teeth removal, for Daniel to take on the flight. When Daniel checked in at the airport and cleared security 6 hours early, he sat at the empty gate and realized he was shaking. In the end, he hadn't been able to do what Peter and Kay wanted. 3 more semesters of classes, followed by graduate school. Staying upstate. He hadn't been able to do what Roland wanted either. Play the music Roland wanted him to play. If he could just talk to his mother in person, maybe he could figure out who he should be. Now, in the hotel, he wished he had her address. All he knew was what she'd told him on the phone, that she lived in a neighborhood called West Lake and worked in a school that taught English. He called and left her another message, took the elevator down to the lobby. "Can you look up an address for me?" he asked the clerk. "A Polly Guo, or Pelan Guo. She lives in Westlake." She might have changed her last name when she got married, but he didn't know her husband's name, only that he owned a textile factory. The only phone book the hotel had was 5 years old.
The clerk flipped through the pages.
Guo. Guo.